Hello, and welcome back to the Fascinating Jobs Podcast. I'm your host, Mackenzie Wilson. On this episode of the podcast, I'm sitting down with Jasmine Chow, student, creator of the popular YouTube channel StudyQuil, and author of the book Study With Me, to talk all things social media, students, and side hustles. As always, please leave a review wherever you listen if you like this podcast. It helps us get recognized. With that, let's get into episode number 2 with Jasmine. All right, so hi, Jasmine. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm excited to have you today. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, or, you know, at least as well as I can be with most of the Bay Area slightly on fire, but luckily I'm still safe at home.
Yeah, that's really good. I'm so glad to hear that you're safe. So I guess let's just get into it then. What inspired you to start creating digital content?
Yeah, sure. So I started making my internet presence known through Tumblr initially in eighth grade in the winter of 2015-ish. I stumbled across the StudyBlur community, which is the niche of Tumblr that is dedicated to aesthetically pleasing notes and study tips and resources. And this was something that I really fell in line with because I've always been a giant nerd who enjoys school. And I also do enjoy nice stationery and neat handwriting, so it felt like a natural fit for me, and I just wanted to get involved in some way. Soon enough after that, I decided to make the jump from Tumblr, which is primarily a blog type of medium, so written text, photos, over to YouTube, where, you know, one makes videos. Mostly because I had gotten a bit bored over the summer, and I wanted to branch out and try something new in the fall. So, video seemed like the next best step to me, since photo is very similar to making videos, I guess. Like, I enjoyed photography, and video clicks with me a little bit more, I guess. I've always enjoyed movies and documentaries as a medium of conveying information, and I thought maybe I would also try my hand at creating this very compelling and immersive type of visual and audio content. And that's how I got inspired to start.
Yeah, so that sounds great, and I agree, like, the study community is kind of like a good way to, I feel like, get integrated. You know, I'm personally into stationery and school and all that too. So were you kind of nervous when you were posting your first YouTube video, or were you a bit apprehensive about it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, whenever you take a first step towards putting yourself out there where people can actually see what you're doing, it's a little bit nerve-wracking. And since I started as a high school freshman, you could definitely hear it in my voice that I was quite stilted and uncomfortable. I didn't even show my face for the first 2 years of my channel just because I was scared that people would think I was ugly, I'm gonna be honest. But at first, I wasn't particularly nervous just because I didn't think. I'd say I wasn't majorly nervous as I would be if I had this current size of an audience, you know, if I already had, say, 600,000 subscribers and I was just gonna post my first video, I would be so nervous. But the first time I posted a video, I was pretty sure that maybe like 3 people and like my neighbor across the street would see it, so it wasn't that bad.
Yeah, that's kind of like a good thing to way to like put it in perspective and kind of see. Yeah, so I imagine that it could be kind of difficult to manage your time between schoolwork and then, as you mentioned, you kind of started in eighth grade, but now you're going to college in the fall, so between creating YouTube videos and Instagram posts and even writing a book, how did you kind of manage your time between that?
Yeah, so one of the strategies that works the best for me is to start by just brain dumping every single thing I need to do for a particular day or week into my bullet journal, or I guess if you don't bullet journal, you could always use a different planner. Then I estimate how long each item will take. So let's say I have a math assignment and it's going to take maybe an hour as an estimate. Or maybe I need to film some B-roll clips and that'll take 2 hours. So once I've figured out the time interval for each one, I take it hour by hour and I plan them out as if they were a kind of event. Like let's say from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. I'll do my math assignment, or from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. I'll work on that video footage. I find it helps to just break it down. It looks a lot more manageable to just see it as, I'm going to show up and do these things for, say, 5 hours, instead of looking at this kind of overwhelming to-do list where you're not really ever sure if it's even possible to finish this gigantic looking list of words.
Yeah, so I think that's a good tip to kind of like break it down and then like say, you know, hey, I'm just gonna show up and just gonna be here. So were there any times where, you know, you just kind of fell off the track or?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, even though I post videos where it seems like I'm productive all the time, I only post videos of me being productive. Everyone, you know, falls off the train sometimes. If I like mess up my schedule or I lose steam on one of my habits, usually I just try to focus, instead of beating myself up on things that I messed up in the past, just looking forward and patching it up retroactively. Of course, I do still kind of berate myself, but I'm, you know, trying to focus, like, I'm mostly working on focusing instead on solution-oriented rather than problem-oriented ways to approach the things I messed up on.
Yeah, I think that's a really good tip, because I feel like we all just kind of like, you know, just have a lazy day, or, I mean, I'll do the same thing. I'll just be like, oh man, I didn't finish that, you know, what should I do? But I think that's a really good tip to just kind of like move past it, look forward. And so good advice. Thank you. I need to take that myself. So how did you decide you wanted to write a book? How did that come about?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be completely honest here. Writing a book was never on my bucket list of things to do, but when the opportunity presented itself, it seemed like so obvious. Like, I totally should have done this. The way it happened was, actually, I have always been, you know, making my video resources, making kind of a library of bullet journal ideas for free on the internet. And there was a publisher that just reached out to me and thought, hey, this is something valuable. You could offer something of value to potential readers. Maybe you can just make a higher quality, more detailed explanation version of all of your tips condensed into one handy guidebook. And, you know, once they presented that idea, I was like, this is so obvious. Of course, this is something that I should do. And yeah.
Yeah, so how is writing the book different from filming one of your videos? You mentioned that it was more in depth, but are there any other ways that it kind of differed?
So the main thing is that it's a little bit more of a formal step-by-step instruction type of guide. In video content, I usually write a bullet point outline, of course, but it's not quite as detailed. It's a lot more me going with the flow, just seeing what comes out of my mouth while I'm recording. Whereas in the book, like, every word is very deliberate. Edited it multiple times in order to make sure things make more sense and are more polished than they are in the videos.
Okay, yeah. So what was the most rewarding part of writing the book?
I think the best part was getting that first copy in the mail and getting it to hold in my hands. I've done yearbook for 4 years. I'm a major bookworm. I love the smell of new books, and the feeling of getting a new book and like smelling the pages like a total freak is one of the best feelings you can totally, geez, how do I even say this? Like, it's one of the best feelings you can have. And, you know, with yearbooks, with books that you've made yourself, it's even more gratifying because you can flip through the pages and point at things and think things like, wow, I made that, or I thought this looked really weird on my screen, but seeing it big and in print just makes it look so much better.
Yeah, I completely get that, and I hope that I have the chance to write a book. That sounds so cool. And so what was your like favorite part of the book, you know, for people who have gotten it or read it? What's the must look at page?
The part that will be most valuable to each person really depends on what you're looking to get out of bullet journaling, since the topics covered vary so much. But the part that I enjoyed making the most was the calligraphy tutorial section that's near the very end of the book. It's chapter 3, which is all about ways that you can beautify your bullet journal. It was really fun for me to make, since I got to play with a bunch of different lettering ideas and then write little descriptions about how to execute them. And I'd say it's one of the most interesting pages to look at for sure.
Yeah, definitely. So how did you get started in calligraphy? That's, I think, an interesting kind of niche on the internet.
When I was pretty small, like in early elementary school, I went to Chinese school to learn my family's language. And one activity that we did pretty often there was traditional calligraphy. It's just something that's been, I guess, part of my culture for a pretty long time. But that was all in Chinese, of course. I won a couple awards from my Chinese school for having nice handwriting, so I got my start early. And then later, around middle school, again, kind of when I started my Tumblr blog, I came across calligraphy as a niche on Instagram, and my friends have always known me as a person who has nice handwriting and is interested in art. So I thought this would be a great way to combine the two of handwriting as art.
Yeah, I think that's really cool. Yeah, I've been trying my hand at calligraphy too, and it's definitely something that's like looks easier than it actually is. And I know you have a bunch of videos about, you know, beginner calligraphy, but what are some good maybe tools you could start with if you're looking to get into calligraphy?
Yeah, I think as you mentioned, calligraphy kind of looks effortless from people who do it well, but I remember from when I first started trying it out, it's definitely really hard to master those particular fine motor skills, like being able to form the letters neatly and apply pressure evenly. It just takes lots and lots of practice. I wouldn't say there's ever really one particular workbook set or pen that will just solve all your problems. Instead, I recommend getting something that's pretty cheap, pretty accessible in order to get started with the habit, see if it's something you're actually interested in, that you actually enjoy. And, you know, a cheaper brush pen isn't going to be as heartbreaking once you inevitably mess it up as a beginner.
Yeah, I think that's a good tip, you know, to just kind of start out with the basics, kind of on the branches of, you know, calligraphy. I know you make a lot of calligraphy videos. So what are your favorite types of videos to film? There is one.
I think I would make a distinction between my favorite types to film and then my favorite types to edit. So for me, my favorite types to film are generally the more chatty style videos where I kind of have a really, really loose outline and then I just kind of ramble on about my life advice, kind of like how an older sibling would talk to their younger siblings and give them tips on how to do well in high school or just function as a person. I find those really interesting to film, but those are not so fun to edit because I spend a lot of time stumbling over my words, and editing those is just a multi-hour process of me staring at myself, but I can't speak for some reason. Like, I just can't make words come out of my mouth in a functional order. The kind of video that is most fun for me to edit is vlog-style videos where the filming process is pretty... I don't want to say it's boring because it's just me going about my daily life, but having the camera on, but it's not necessarily something I really love to do because it forces me to take myself out of the moment and instead see my life through like a camera lens. But those are really fun to edit because they result in some of the most visually appealing shots. It adds a lot more variety than simply me talking in front of a camera or me writing on a piece of paper.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. So I know that you mentioned that editing was particularly difficult for certain types of videos. So is editing like the most challenging part of the video process, or are there other parts where it's super difficult?
Yeah, I'd say editing is definitely the most time-consuming part of the process. For something like, say, a 14-minute video, I would usually have about 30 minutes of footage of me talking, maybe 30 more minutes of other B-roll shots, which are things that are not my head talking, but other objects or events happening around. And then it's maybe at least 5 hours of editing behind that because I stumble over my words a lot, so that's a flaw that I need to work on in order to improve my editing process. But even though that's the most time-consuming, I wouldn't say it's the hardest. For me, at least, the hardest is actually outlining and writing the video content. something about just staring down that blank document, having nothing on there except maybe 5 words of a vague idea, is really intimidating. I'm sure we've all experienced that writer's block syndrome where that blank document just looks so terrifying. And I just find that the hardest because with everything else, with filming, with editing, you have something else as a base to jump off of, but the first time you really write it down, pretty nerve-wracking, pretty difficult.
Yeah, and I think that that's one thing about videos that people don't necessarily realize is how long and how much effort like really goes into them and how long you're spending editing and filming. And you mentioned that like coming up with the ideas is pretty challenging. So how do you decide what videos you're going to film?
To start off with, there are some videos that are just cookie cutter, like a pretty standard box of a video that you know that people will generally watch, like what's in my backpack or study with me. They're just things that you can repeat over and over within one template, but you fill it with different content each time, you know, because I'll have different things in my backpack each year, or I'll study something different in each video. So that's one way that I generate ideas. Another thing that I like to do is to take inspiration from content that isn't really within my study niche. For example, sure, I could kind of copy other study tubers and the ideas they come up with, but just interpret them with my own advice. But I don't really want to do that because I want to bring something more unique to the table of the StudyGram community. So one thing I do is look at other YouTube genres. Like, lately I've been really into the personal finance side of YouTube, and then borrow some of their video concepts and topics and ideas. For example, in the personal finance realm, there's a pretty common topic of mistakes that you need to avoid or habits that you should take up in order to maximize certain efficiency things. And those aren't necessarily talked about as much in the StudyTube community, so I just bring over some of those concepts into things like mistakes to avoid in your first year of high school, or habits to start doing now so that you can be more productive.
Yeah, so do you kind of, you mainly said that you make videos that, you know, like you would enjoy to watch and you would enjoy. Have you ever had to make videos where you're like, oh man, you know, I don't know if this is a good idea, but I think lots of people will watch it?
I think with every YouTuber, there's a little bit of pandering to the audience for sure. I mean, in rare cases, some people just do whatever they want, but I am not the exception to the rule. Although I wouldn't ever do something just to try to get views, it is somewhat of a priority, albeit lower than what I think I would enjoy, what I think would provide actual value to people. Maybe like the third priority is, are people actually going to watch this? Part of that is just because I have to make brand deals and I kind of have a responsibility to them to not just spit out random garbage. And I have a responsibility to myself and to people who like my videos to do quality control in the aspect of things that are relevant to my audience are things that will ultimately provide more value to them, and therefore are likely to get more views.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and especially along the lines of brand deals. So is that one of the more challenging parts of having a YouTube channel or social media presence, or is there something else that might be more challenging?
I think the first challenge, the hardest challenge, is to be consistent enough to actually build an audience. When you first start on social media, unless you're incredibly lucky, nobody is going to watch your videos, to be brutally honest. It takes a lot of time of just throwing your content into the void and just doing it because you enjoy it, because you want to improve, because you just care that much about maybe the 10 people who are watching. But once you get over that hump, I would say at my current stage in my YouTube career, where I have a pretty stable audience, brand deals are definitely the thing I've struggled with the most. I think many young women, and young men of course, but especially young women, struggle to put dollar values or charge money for what they're really worth. I mean, of course, this isn't limited to age or gender or anything like that, but when you're constantly told that you have to be humble, it's hard to say, like, if you want me to talk about this, I'm worth this amount, and you can't convince me otherwise. I don't really know how to express this in an eloquent way, but the confidence it takes to negotiate with brands and to accept that you have influence is one of the hardest things for me to work on. And one way I've been able to circumvent that issue is to have an outside management team, which is not really necessary for the average smaller YouTuber because the fees that they're going to be taking are a little bit too high to balance out the amount of revenue you generally get. But for me, at this current point, I get far too many emails each day, and I really no longer understand just how complicated the contracts are getting. I no longer fully understand how to value my channel metrics when my channel metrics are changing consistently. It's been pretty helpful to me to just have someone out there who actually knows the landscape and can help me trudge through all of these confusing business terms, especially since as a student, I don't have that much free time to be reading emails for hours.
Yeah, I totally get that. And I think that we were kind of talking about this on the previous episode of the podcast, just kind of knowing your worth and kind of like showing your value. And I feel like that's even something that, I mean, I'm starting out on this whole podcast thing, but you know, before I reach out to someone, I'm like, oh man, like, would they be insulted if I asked them? Like, you know, they wouldn't want to come on like my show. But so how did you kind of decide that you were like, okay, it's time to, you know, maybe hire some outside management? What was your kind of threshold on that?
Yeah, for me, it was just, I kind of reached a breaking point this summer, actually. I've recently transitioned over into taking college classes through summer classes, and the workload has definitely been a lot different from high school. So that's been one additional constraint on my time. And I'm at like a critical mass where I don't want to be spending, say, half an hour to an hour on my email every single day. The like kind of critical mass breaking point is different for every person. But for me, I've decided that the fees from the management are now worth the amount of time and mental strain I'd be saving.
I definitely get that. Yeah. What are some tips that you'd give to students who are looking to start a social media presence themselves?
As I kind of mentioned earlier, one of the best ways to get started is to just accept the kind of instability of it. There is no guarantee that if you make good videos, it will automatically translate to a large audience or to large revenue, because that's just not really how the internet works, unfortunately. I think the most important thing is to get started and to just keep going, find an intrinsic motivation that isn't views or money or even quantity of comments or likes. The motivation should really come from you enjoying the process, or you enjoying interactions with just a few people who are watching. It's really easy to start at a certain point, but it's much harder to persist even if you're not getting the results that you hope for. But the persistence is what really makes someone. It's what, in the majority of cases, there are always exceptions, people who just go instantly viral, but in the majority of cases, the persistency to go on in the face of what looks like failure but really isn't failure is what takes you to the next level.
Yeah, so what are your kind of strategies for, you know, kind of persisting and getting over that, you know, original hump?
One of the main things for me was to set up a consistent schedule. As you probably could tell from my calendar scheduling method of planning, I'm a person who really enjoys sticking to schedules and routines. It just works for my brain in a kind of way that I can't quite explain. I'm not sure if everyone is like this, but I'm definitely like this. And I set up an expectation with my audience that I would have a new video every week. In the early days of my channel, I did 2 videos a week, but they were not very good videos. They did not take much work. So now I've switched to 1 video a week, but having these sort of deadlines for yourself are a really helpful way to just make yourself keep going. And you can always stop if you like, but I would advise to set up checkpoints of when you're allowed to stop instead of just being allowed to stop whenever you have a sudden change of heart. So for example, let's say I would give myself 3 to 6 months. And if at the end of 3 months, I just don't want to do this thing anymore, I would be allowed to quit. But if at 2.5 months, I have a slight dip in my motivation or a slight dip in my views, I'm not allowed to quit until I make it all the way through to the end of the trial period.
Yeah, I think that's a really good tip. And I feel like that's something that we've all experienced. You know, if you're on a sports team when you're younger and you want to quit after the first practice, but then your parents make you stick it out, I think that's like a really good way to keep yourself accountable for it. And that kind of goes with like persisting, as you were saying before. So do you find that one video a week is generally manageable for you, or how has that been working out?
Yeah, I find with my current schedule, one video a week is pretty manageable. The amount of work that each video takes varies quite a bit. So having this kind of schedule allows me to maybe work on one video for half a week and then a longer or harder to make video for a week and a half, which I find very convenient. I don't think I'd have that kind of flexibility if I was on a tighter schedule. But at the same time, I don't want to post too few videos. I know that the YouTube algorithm wants to favor people who post more than one a week, but I reasonably cannot with my current study schedule and classes and everything. So I try not to do too few videos, but I think these kind of scheduling choices really depend on how much time you want to commit. Like for me, I can commit a lot more time than say someone who has to work a part-time job, because for me, YouTube makes me enough income to be my part-time job.
Yeah, I think that's another difficult balance, that there's maybe a fine line between when you should be posting or how much, how frequently. So if you could fix one mistake that you made when starting out, what would it be?
I think the biggest mistake I made in the very beginning of my YouTube channel was maybe about half a year or a year into it. I got kind of burnt out and complacent. I was at the kind of point where it seemed like no matter what I did, even if it wasn't very good, people would still show up and watch it, mostly because the StudyTube community was really making a huge surge in popularity, and I was one of the first few YouTubers to really get into that niche. So it felt like even though my ego was way too big and my quality was really not living up to my own internal standards, it still felt like I was on top of the world. And I really don't like that I let those metrics of views and numbers get in my way of meeting my own standards of high quality videos, like information of value. And I really wish I hadn't done that.
Yeah, I definitely think that's a good reminder. And I think that kind of goes along with what we were saying earlier, you know, kind of like knowing your worth, kind of talking about the StudyTube community. You were mentioning how you were one of the first YouTubers on that. So what was it like being kind of the pioneer of this new community?
At the time, I didn't really know that I was a pioneer. I mean, I had jumped over from StudyBlur, which was already a pretty established niche of the internet. So I guess it didn't really feel like anything at first, but looking back, I can definitely see that I was one of the earlier leaders on this trend. I can see the influence of my note-taking style on so many other study Instagrams, and it's super gratifying because, I mean, I was just like a random teenager who had barely gone through high school, and somehow I had influenced a lot of different people to start sharing their content, or a lot of people to be more inspired and to find more joy in schoolwork. And although at the time I didn't really understand what I was getting up to, looking back, it seems pretty gratifying, and hopefully moving forward, I've been trying to find ways to continue to not necessarily pioneer a new niche, that's pretty ambitious, but to continue to evolve and not be stuck in a certain box.
On the topic of evolving, as you're now transitioning to going to college in the fall, how do you expect your content will change?
Honestly, I'm still trying to figure it out as I go. I've been doing YouTube for 4 years, and so far, I've enjoyed it for all those 4 years, but, you know, interests change, and maybe later on I just won't enjoy it as much anymore. I really have no way of knowing, since I'm still in the process of growing up, still have a lot to discover about myself and what I like. But I'd say that, at least for my freshman year of college, I definitely plan to do a bit more sharing of my life type of content. You know, going to university, especially at a pretty well-known university, is definitely a lot more vlog-worthy and interesting to audiences than just regular life at a suburban high school.
Yeah, and I like that you kind of mentioned that term, like, evolving. You know, your content's going to go through new stages of life, just like you. And yeah, so, I mean, good luck in the fall at UCLA. So I think I mean, I'm just starting the college process myself. So it seems like it's always been nice to see somebody on, like, the other side of that. And yeah, I'm just like, oh, man, like, Jasmine did it. Like, I can do this too, you know?
Yeah, I mean, 100% survival rate at my high school, at least, so I think you'll make it out.
Awesome, yeah, fingers crossed. Kind of on the topic of college, so how are you planning to kind of start this fall virtually? You know, what's your kind of strategy going into that?
So far, I've been very confused about what exactly our housing status is. UCLA housing has done a lot of going back and forth, so we'll see how being on campus ends up, but I'm not expecting anything. All of my classes are completely online, so I'm honestly not sure whether I should move out at all. That's still a debate that I'm going over at this current point. UCLA is on the quarter system. Our first day of class is actually October 1st this year, which sounds super crazy. So right now I'm just focusing on wrapping up my summer classes, hopefully getting good grades in those, and improving my online study technique.
Yeah, so I hope you kind of find closure in that situation. And so, as you mentioned, summer classes, what's been the biggest difference between your high school classes and now your college classes?
Yeah, college classes are definitely a lot more self-directed. The teacher isn't writing the homework on the board every day or checking it every single class period and telling you 2 days before the essay is due to remind you. You get the syllabus at the beginning of the year with all of your readings, all of your lecture schedules, all your discussion sections, when the tests are, and that's it. You're kind of on your own to keep yourself on top of assignments, to have things due on time, to attend things without someone badgering you to do it.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, these skills, you know, just kind of like self-accountability, and I'm kind of seeing a pattern here. So are these skills that you kind of also used in your YouTube channel that you're kind of seeing being transferred over to these college level academics?
Yeah, for sure. That's a very insightful observation. They're very similar in that although you kind of have a long-term commitment, as in my long-term goal for YouTube is to, you know, post videos and hopefully benefit people, and the long-term goal for the class is to learn the content and perhaps get a good grade as a side benefit, it's hard to stay focused on those overarching, faraway ideas when you're, you know, week by week, day by day, kind of lacking in a direction. So being able to set up those mini deadlines or holding yourself accountable to a schedule are really valuable in both aspects.
Yeah, so could you kind of explain a bit more what your strategy is as term of, like, reaching those, as you put it, longer-term goals with, like, you know, you mentioned shorter-term goals?
One of the main things that I find helpful is to break it down into those smaller deadlines and tasks. So let's say my longer-term goal is to get an A on the final for this class. Then I would need to look at the syllabus, look at all of the lectures, how many there are, how many readings there are, like what kind of content I need to be studying, and then break those down into maybe by week two, I will finish the first assigned reading, or on, say, August 31st, I will do reading from pages 4 to 10, or, you know, things like that. I can't quite give specific examples right now, but just breaking it down step by step, like, you know, you eat an elephant one bite at a time, and you've got to finish those big assignments and big goals one tiny bit at a time.
Yeah, I think that's definitely good advice for, you know, people going to college, but also I think people still in high school like myself, I think online classes this semester are going to be a lot more self-directed and, you know, just kind of self-accountability, like, you know, maybe I don't have to be on that Zoom call every day, but I should probably be going.
For sure.
Yeah, so I guess just one last kind of wrap-up question. What's your strategy going into these online classes this fall?
I think my main goal is to just not get distracted during Zoom lectures. I find that's one of the hardest parts for me. I can make myself focus and do my readings on time, but when I'm on my laptop with the Zoom app open, it's just so easy for me to just click on my internet browser and just go on Facebook or text a friend. And that's really not something I should be doing. I should definitely be paying attention to my lectures. One thing that I'm going to be trying to work on is to block everything that is distracting. I recently installed a Chrome extension, Forest, which is similar to the iPhone app that I'm sure many people have heard of, which will block any distracting websites for a set period. So let's say I have a 2-hour lecture, I'll just go on Google Chrome right before it, and then block Messenger and YouTube and all those kinds of websites for 2 hours.
Yeah, I think that's a really good tip, and I think that's something that everyone's struggling with these days. I know that's like my main thing, you know, my phone's right there and my computer. So I think that's a really good tip. I think that was all that I had for today's discussion. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. I mean, I'm really glad to be contributing to such a cool audio resource for students.
A special thanks to Jasmine for being the guest on today's episode. You can check her out on Instagram or YouTube at StudyQuill, and check out her book, Study With Me. It's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Jasmine is a great resource for students of all ages. She posts study tips, bullet journaling videos, and talks about life as a student. You can check out this podcast on Instagram at @fascinating_jobs_pod, Twitter at @fascinatingjobs, or you can check out our website www.fascinatingjobs.xyz. Be sure to rate or review this podcast wherever you listen to let us know you're enjoying it. And if you or someone you know has a fascinating job, email us at fascinatingjobspod@gmail.com for a chance to be a guest on the show. Thank you so much for listening and enjoying this podcast, and I'll see you in the next episode.